The opinions and statements expressed in the following program do not necessarily reflect those of WWDB, its staff, or management.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, around the Delaware Valley on a beautiful, beautiful Monday afternoon. Welcome to the American Justice Radio Network with Sonny Banks. We're sponsored by Pinnacle Medical Plus and Tony Shuler. I'm your co-host, Joe Dougherty. Sonny, how are you, sir?
Doing great. I'm a little disappointed that Villanova lost on Saturday, but they gave it a good shot.
They did. And it's amazing. I was thinking about you today because we talked about the tournament last week. And certainly, Bauer came out going, really all guns a-blazing in the second half.
They did. And Nova was undermanned. They didn't have their starting point guard.
And of course, they Colin Gillespie, and they kept scanning the crowd for him during the you saw it.
Right.
So that would have been a completely and totally and utterly different ball game.
I agree, because it was they really failed to protect the basketball.
Yeah, you cannot replace Colin Gillespie. Obviously, reminds me. Of my high school days when I got injured. No, just kidding. Sonny. For a second there, I lost myself. It was a JV game. I got hurt. That's not important.
There's always next year.
Yeah, and there will be.
Yeah.
Nova's. What's the makeup of their team as far as the ages? Class.
Well, because of COVID, I think the NCAA gave everybody an extra year. So,
Gillespie done though, right?
No, Gillespie's coming back.
Oh,
that would be my guess. He has the option of coming back or not coming back, and I think that most of the other starters will be back.
Oh, well, then we do have next year.
Yeah,
that's a big one.
Yep,
we'll see if we can get him on the line and maybe talk him into coming. I know we have a big Villanova guy in the house. No, maybe not. No. My son went to Temple also. So I went to, we're going to introduce our guest in a second. But my son went to Temple. And I think my wife and I became Villanova basketball fans when they won the championship on that last second shot a couple years ago.
Right.
I like the Big Five. So I when St. Joe's was in the Final Four,
right?
And it was unbelievable.
Yeah,
we were right. But my wife and I typically, with the Eagles, Phillies, Sixers, and Flyers, our son's typically on our side, right? So I remember when Nova was playing, it was one of the tournament games, and we're like, "Yo, Joe, you're watching the game?" He's like, "Dad, no, I'm not watching the game. I went to Temple. I hate Villanova." I'm like, "Holy cow, what the heck's going on?" Sonny, if you would, introduce our guest.
Sure. We have attorney Fabio Chirino with us today. Fabio was last on the program in February of 2020. He's a Philadelphia trial lawyer who handles all types of catastrophic personal injury cases. Fabio has his own firm, the Law Office of Fabio Chirino. He also has an affiliation with the Emanuel Law Firm. Fabio Chirino honed his trial skills doing both plaintiff and civil defense work, as well as still doing some limited criminal defense work. He's very well-rounded in that he speaks three languages, English, Italian, and Spanish. His aggressive yet focused approach to representing his clients has proven to be very successful. The catchphrases on Fabio's webpage couldn't be more accurate in describing him and his practice. Those phrases are an innovative civil litigation firm, justice seekers, unrelenting advocates, altogether different. Fabio, if you would, please tell our listeners about yourself and about your law firm.
Good morning, Sonny. Good morning, Joe. Good to be back, guys. Thank you for having me again. Listeners, good to be here. My practice is largely focused on medical malpractice, but I do all the gamut of personal injury law. My colleagues and I work on motor vehicle accident cases, slip and falls, but my particular focus is always on medical malpractice, particularly misdiagnosis of cancer, untimely diagnosis of cancer. Those are the things that I really enjoy doing and trying to fight for the rights of injured parties who have been untimely diagnosed with cancer.
I noticed also, I was reading your resume, when you have a lot of experience. In other words, when you brought it, you came into and choosing your area of law. You at one point worked in the Philadelphia DA's office.
I did for a brief period of time after law school. I did a little stint in the Philadelphia DA's office.
And also, and so you represent clients, but you also have the experience on the defense side also. And so it's a wide array of experience. Can you tell us about that experience that led to where you are today, and you know that helps you in representing your clients today?
Sure. So with the Philly DA's office, it really, from day one, they really get you out there and being in front of judges and in front of the juries. Towards the later part of my year at the DA's office, I was in front of juries, but a lot of bench trials, so you're up on your feet thinking very, very early on. But then being on the defense side and spending several years on the defense med-mal side, I got to see kind of like their tricks, so
wow,
to speak. So
wow.
I see what they're doing in the background and preparing their cases, you know, preparing to defend their cases. So that gives me, I think, a leg up. It gives me an advantage on the plaintiff side because I can not just be able to work up a plaintiff's case, but I can foresee the potential.
Like a chess
issues.
Game, you can map it out to your client and say, here's what's going on right now. I did not know that. I don't think we've ever had somebody on the program that has done defense med mal,
right.
And has that experience. And that is a long, drawn out times. Give us an idea of how that experience in real life you can translate to your client and say, okay, here's what's going on.
Sure. So I know in advance, for example, I'll go in depth at the initial interview I have with my clients. I'll ask them things that I can foresee being asked at a deposition 2 years down the road. So there's not even a suit in litigation. I don't even know if the case is ready for a suit or if there's even a potential case. But I'm already reviewing those things in advance because I know those are going to be details that they're going to be the defense side is going to be looking at. Criminal history, if they have a litigious nature. Those things are all going to be scrutinized by the defense to try to put holes in the plaintiff's case. So in addition to, you know, it's kind of like alongside, in addition to working up the case to make sure that there is a potential med mal claim there that I can pursue and put in litigation, I'm also looking at what are the potential pitfalls that my client is going to have to go through and be prepared for at a deposition, at trial. So I'm thinking well in advance. And the funny part is many times as I'm talking to defense counsel on a case and I say, I already know you're going to do X. So let's just cut to the chase and let's avoid that. Let's play civil. Let's play nice and get this case in front of a jury.
So if I was a defense attorney, I go, who told you that? Are you kidding? I'm not doing that.
And the funny part about how that ends up working is I also know risk managers, and I know general counsel at the health system.
So you're part of the community. In other words, you understand. There you go.
And then when they assign an attorney, I get a counsel that I worked with before, and we can cut through a lot of that stuff because they already know. Like, we can't play that with Fabio. He knows already what our move is going to be on to try to debunk this theory or try to debunk that claim. So let's move along a little bit more smoothly and.
That's got to be, Sonny, in your world, in the workers' compensation world, almost got to be kind of like the same with you. They know when Sonny Banks walks in, it's not his first day in court. Right?
Yeah, and I had the luxury of doing defense comp work, too. And, Fabio's absolutely right. When you do defense work, they tend to throw you right into the fray right away. I mean, I think because they've got more resources to allow young attorneys to get into the mix to start doing trials and arbitrations. Whereas the plaintiff side, tends to be a little more conservative.
Of course. I find it interesting when you're dealing with clients and they're in a total panic, I mean, you know, everything scares somebody whose, you know, life is in jeopardy, get a piece of mail and, you know, it's got all this legal jargon on it, to be able to settle them and educate them in the process. Let's talk about comprises a med mal case because
Before we get there, can we find out? The misdiagnosis of cancer patients is a fairly narrow niche. What brought you to that?
So I think it's just by the type of cases that were coming along and what I noticed. I was well adapted to follow. It's a very, very complex area to practice. Yeah. You need to know the medicine a lot. You need to work alongside your medical experts a lot. You need to be able to read the medical records really, really well and understand what's going on. Look for that kind of, you know, needle in the haystack, because that's what cancer really is.
Yeah.
It's one of those really complex cases that you really need to know what you're doing to find out what has gone wrong. And then to the next level, is there an actual lawsuit here that could be brought on behalf of, you know, most of the time it's the decedent's family, but right. if the patient is still alive, can I bring a case on their behalf? Is there an action there? And those are really complicated aspects that really I got drawn to, because not everybody can do this. You know, even if you're looking at orthoscopic surgery, you know, that's complicated, but you kind of have a finite, you know, area you're working with. With cancer, you know, there's plenty of theories that are at play at any one time. And so you need to look at the case from all those multiple angles to determine, is this actionable or is it not? You know, did the doctor actually breach the standard of care, or did he do everything he could and this is just a bad outcome?
Yeah, the medicine can't be easy. Do you have a medical background, Fabio?
I do not, but especially when I worked on the defense side, I was fortunate enough to work with a supervising attorney who had a medical background. And she impressed on me very early on, you really have to study it from the medicine aspect. Yeah. You know the law. You've gone to law school. You've done everything you need to do to prepare yourself on the law. But you really have to look at each case with a doctor hat on, in a sense.
Oh, yeah.
So you really have to understand the medicine, work hard on studying the medicine to understand, did the doctor do something right?
That was the first thing I thought of. Because if you really think about it from a layman standpoint, you're trying to look at negligence that may have caused cancer to spread. I can only imagine how many areas where that's possible. How about drugs? You know, specific drugs, cancer causing drugs. Is that a part of it?
I don't look at it from that aspect so much. My aspect is more of some sort of screening, like a colonoscopy or, you know, a mammogram or something like that should have been done based on the person's risk factors, their age, their sex, their race. Those things are important. And if I can see that that wasn't done, then I take it to the next level.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, your practice actually involves challenging the doctor who's being sued on the medicine. I depose doctors on a regular basis, but it's more of a factual thing, you know, what the physician may have missed or overlooked, as opposed to actually challenging them on the medicine. And that cannot be easy, because obviously, you know, Fabio didn't go to law school. I mean, didn't go to medical school, and he's challenging somebody who did.
Yeah, you have to get really creative, because a lot of these doctors, they're a lot smarter than me. They've been doing that particular thing, that particular practice of medicine for decades.
I would say this. I don't think anybody's a lot smarter than you, and I'll tell you why. I say that because it's so amazing. I think we've been doing this for 5-6 years, and we've only had a handful maximum of real medical malpractice attorneys.
True.
What that means is, a lot of people listening. So there's obviously a lot of great attorneys in the city of Philadelphia, and some firms really do med mal. But you could go if you're starting from scratch and you're looking in the yellow pages or online, if they even use the yellow pages. But my point is, you see med mal, many of those people. Market it, but they send the cases out to somebody.
Right, you have a lot of dabblers.
Right. I mean, that's my point. So people who actually really, do med mal are far and few between.
Yeah.
And there's reasons for that. Having said that, talk about how many times, Sonny, I mean, I've had one, and I don't know if we spoke about it on the last on the last show we did, but with Fabio. But one guy who swore he had a medical malpractice case, he was in trouble too. He had some issues, but he didn't have one, or he had one and it just wasn't valuable enough to go through the hell that he was going to have to do waiting, and then have a case or any settlement at the end. Having said that, talk about the many facets Like, what do you have to prove? What are you looking for when you're looking at a med mal case in regards to negligence, and really deciding on whether, you know, vetting the case, deciding whether you think it's a case and you're going to take it?
Sure. So the very first thing I do is I want to make sure I have a very detailed conversation with the client. It's an interview. And I'm asking a lot of questions. I'm reviewing whatever medical records they do have. Most of the time, they don't have medical records, or at least the pertinent ones that I need to review to understand if there was anything wrong done. And I ask very, very pointed questions over and over again to try to understand the whole picture. The client is always going to see it from their perspective, but I need to see the doctor's perspective too. And that comes from reviewing the records and understanding what did this doctor document, or what is likely missed, what is likely not documented in here and should have been. So I need to understand that aspect. So after the client interview, get all the entire medical records, make sure I have the entire medical records, because a lot of times the doctors or health systems, they purposely will not provide all the records because they know there's a potential litigation that could ensue if they do divulge all these records. So once I know I have all the medical records, I review them and to see exactly, create like a timeline, a chronology of what happened here? What was the care? What did this doctor do? What was the standard of care? What was this doctor responsible for doing? And, or she, did they fail doing that? And if so, is that a breach in the standard of care? Were they required by the standard of care to do X and they didn't? And because they didn't, that's a breach in standard of care. So that's the first level. Next level is I got to be able to establish that there, what happened to this patient is a direct cause of this doctor's breach in the standard of care. So what did this doctor do or fail to do cause the harm that the plaintiff, that the patient now has? If yes, okay, what is that worth? So now it's the third level. What is that worth in the context of the jurisdiction, in the context of recent jury verdicts or, you know, recent settlements that I'm able to gather? And then discuss that with the client, because medical malpractice is a very expensive area, and you're spending thousands and thousands of dollars even before you know whether there's a
problem. You're vetting when you're vetting the
exactly.
case.
Yeah, I have to be able to engage medical experts who are quite expensive to even just determine if, I mean, and that's by law, to even just determine if there is a potential case here. And even after I do all that process, there might be a recognition that, yeah, even though there was a breach in the standard of care, the damages are just not sufficient to really get a reasonable return to this injured party, this plaintiff or the patient.
And what affects damages? Is it a patient dying as opposed to a patient having cancer and then surviving? I mean, which case has more value generally?
So the things I look at will be the pain and suffering. If it's a case of patient passing away, I'll look at the pain and suffering, their age, their sex, their how, you know, if they were married, if they had children, if they contributed to the family, how so, were they employed, what kind of job did they have, was there expectations of continued employment going into the future, you know, what kind of was salary were they expecting. Those are all aspects that I look into it together, and then I go one step down. So if it's a decedent case, I look at the family itself. What is the loss to the spouse, you know, if the parents are still living, or that the parents, the children, what is the loss? And it's got to be a quantifiable loss. It can't just be, I would see my, you know, my dad once a week. We would talk on the phone. Well, what is that in terms of dollar sign?
Right.
Because that's what a jury is going to have to award. It's got to be a dollar amount. So I was regularly getting X number of dollars from my dad every week, or he was paying for my college tuition, or whatever the case may be. And then so all those kind of get added together. But usually the largest component of these misdiagnosed cancer or delayed diagnosed cancer cases is the pain and suffering. So if there is a significant delay that then caused a prolonged,
how do you put a value on a human life in some cases?
And that's the part that I know I don't speak alone in this, but it is a complicated aspect of personal injury that which was different. But I have this conversation with my clients all the time where I explain to them, like, this is our system. So we have to work with the system we have. So in order to get to the level that most accurately approximates what the loss is to you and your family, you need to speak in detail. What was your relationship like? What did you lose? What do you not have now because this person is in your life anymore? And the same thing, if the person was just is still alive, what things can you not do today or not do as well or as much of because of the cancer diagnosis? And of course, that's left in the hands of a jury to decide what that means. I can't tell them a number.
You're like the ultimate, like you have to actually, there's so many factors involved. It's almost like
Svengali.
Yeah, right. It's almost like picking. I don't mean that. You know, like trying to pick factors of stocks, like what is, you know, to decide on what's a case. Like, you know, to you almost have to go through the whole process. How long does it take you to vet a case when somebody comes in on average? Because you got to retain them as a client. And if you take 7 months, they'll be going out the door.
Well, because of how complicated MedMal is, it usually takes me no less than 6 months. And I tell them up front, this is not a simple case where I just kind of get a police report and some of the photos and videos, and I can tell if there's a problem there or not.
Right.
This is complicated. I need to make sure I have all the records, and then also know about their background too. What other care were they receiving? You know, if I'm gonna recommend to my client, yes, there's a potential action against X doctor, but they were also seeing three other doctors for the same thing, and those doctors were doing what they were supposed to do. I can't fault the
It seems like setting expectations up front is like a huge part of the case.
Yeah, that's extremely important in your practice.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing is, in terms of doctor care or hospital care, that period of time is pretty finite. And that's the only thing that a defense attorney has to work with. They only have to defend that time period.
Right.
But we all have, you know, backgrounds. We have histories. So to the extent that there's criminal histories I have to be concerned with, periods of lack of employment, you know, spousal disputes, anything. And that's why I get into those things with my clients early on.
Is there a statute of limitations on actually filing a case?
There is. 2 years from the time of either death or the time that the person should have known that there's a potential claim.
And just so the listeners know, all of this investigation, requesting records, and vetting that you're doing is at no cost to the client, correct?
That's correct. They sign a contingency fee agreement, meaning I don't get paid unless they get paid. So if we take a case, we file a lawsuit, we go all the way to jury trial, and it, God forbid, we are not able to get an award on behalf of the plaintiff. Ugh. They don't owe me anything. Of course, we don't ever get to that point because I've been successful enough. I've been blessed enough to be successful in front of particularly Philadelphia juries. But it is a possibility it can happen. And my clients know that going in, starting from day one. This is exactly what the case is going to look like. And here's the roadmap for the next 24 months.
But even in the case where you decide not to take it and you've done some extensive investigation, the client's not charged.
That's correct. Yeah. And one of the things I wrestle with, it depends on the client. Sometimes I will share with them, you know, look at everything I've done. Just so you don't think I was sitting on this for 6 months, 7 months, 8 months, just to come back and tell you there is no case here. I'll literally show them my records so they can see this is all I've collected. Look at all these records I have. Look at these bills that I've had to pay. And that's fine. You don't owe me anything. I'm sorry that I can't build a case here. But, you know, and the recommendation I always give them is I'm one attorney. This is my recommendation based on what I've seen, how I've looked at these records. You know, I recommend you go see another attorney. Because they see it from a different angle.
How important is communication even during that process of 7 months? What is your policy on that? Now, you know, how often, you know, between visits or communications do you like to talk to the client?
So after I see them at the first interview, I tell them, you probably won't hear from me for the next 21 to 30 days because that is the process that of me getting the ball rolling and getting records. So the moment they come in for the client interview, I have them sign the fee agreement, records releases,
all that
stuff.
Before you go any farther, the client, I could just say, well, you're going to be hearing from me every other day, so I'm not going to worry about you calling me.
And
I'm going to set my own expectation, but I'm sure you hear that on occasion.
And that's what I was going to say is, but I tell them, you are okay to call me. I don't mind taking your call. And I give them my direct line because they don't have to go through my secretary or paralegal or administrative assistant. They go to me because I'm the one that's handling their case.
Sure.
So I tell them, you might not hear from me in the first, you know, next 21, 30 days, but feel free to call me. I might not have an update, but I'll tell you what I have.
Right. Mm-hmm. You know, nurturing these cases so much, you know, the guy that I had talked to, he was an iron worker, had an issue with his elbow. What I love about really good medical malpractice attorneys is you're so experienced at what you do. I got the guy was, I saw Sonny's heard me talk about it. It didn't sound to me like he was going to be able to spend the rest of his life thinking he got screwed over by a doctor. And finally, a friend of mine, not a friend, but an attorney we know, gave me one of the greatest explanations. And I called the guy and I gave it to him. And I know it put him at peace. He understood that he might have a case. But the case itself, you know, the chances are there wouldn't have been enough of a return in it. He just swore that the doctor was intimidating everybody and that wasn't going to happen. And my point is that it's such a specialized area. Having that type of experience to, you know, that you are able to provide to somebody has got to be, especially at the beginning and talking it out, has got to be half of the battle. And because I'm assuming that, you know, getting through it and being a legal counselor and a personal counselor is at least a decent portion of you know, the case itself, getting that client to be able to hang on, to be able to do it.
Yeah. And it's there's quite a bit of explaining the expectations.
Yeah.
That's number one. But then there is quite a bit of handholding.
Sure.
Because they're looking at what happened from a first-person perspective.
They're looking at what's going on this week. It's obvious.
right.
Yeah, and they come with their prejudice, their biases, because it's happened to them. It's happened to their family member. I have to explain to them the whole story. And, of course, as their counsel, as their attorney, I'm putting the spin on to highlight their case as best as possible.
Yeah.
But I need to explain that to them, that it might not be as clear-cut in terms of presenting to a jury as it is in your mind.
Yeah. I think it's hard for an ordinary person to understand that not every bad medical result means that something went wrong.
Correct. Yeah.
Yeah. That's it.
Less than favorable medical results happen every day.
Yeah.
But you know, the key is to identify some element of malpractice in order for you know, a client to have a successful claim.
When you're dealing with cancer claims, also, how often is it that you're dealing with a wrongful death suit as much as, I mean, in comparison to somebody who's still alive, but obviously it's a difficult situation.
Right. I would say about 70% is wrongful death, survival kind of actions. But I do have several cases, and these are particularly in the misdiagnosed breast cancer cases, where the client is still alive and they're still within that 5-year survival rate that they've been given by their oncologist. But before we can even conclude the litigation, because it takes quite a while, they pass away. So then it transfers over to a wrongful death and survival kind of claim. Those are really tough cases, and I get several of those each year because you're working through it to try to get this person. And I'll be honest with you, a lot of times for them, it's not so much the monetary aspect of it. They understand that what that's for, but they understand it's more for their family at that point. Yeah. But for them, the important part is to get an answer.
Right.
And a lot of times you can't get that answer from the doctors. Why did this happen? But with what I do with them is I try to get that before them. So at least I can have, you know, confront the doctor with her sitting next to me or the patient sitting next to me. And the doctor tries his best to explain it. It's not going to be admissible in court, perhaps. It's not going to be something that's going to hold up to get a plaintiff's.
So you're able to sometimes have that conversation. Let me just say this. You know, your bedside manner is unbelievable. I can,
thank you.
You know, and to me personally, and having that compassion, which is what you have, and also the experience and all of those other. That's why there's not guys like us walking the streets on Market Street.
So
just thinking about that process, how do you prepare yourself emotionally for it? Because I'm having a hard time, and we're just talking about it.
I try as best as I can because sometimes I just get the calls, you know, late at night or in the Sunday afternoon. You know, clients tell me, look, I'm going into the hospital just to let you know, if you can't get a hold of me, speak to my husband, or I'm going because this is what's happening to me. And again, going into cancer diagnosis kind of cases. So I try to schedule as best as possible when I'm going to be talking to my clients, because I want them to be at ease talking to me, and we're having a conversation. I'm not, you know, it's not an interrogation. It's not a deposition. We're having a nice, comfortable conversation. So for me, I just prepare myself that way. I say, I'm just going to have a conversation with them, and whatever information they give me, it's important for me to understand it as the whole overall story. And I try not to attach emotions to it, because it's not fair for me to carry their story with me and you know, as part of my day. You know, that part of the story is important. I need to show them how it affects me emotionally during that conversation. But then I need to kind of compartmentalize that. Yeah. Put that away, because it's not mine. Those emotions don't belong to me. Those belong to my
you
client.
Need to have a clear head to be able to.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I can't even imagine what it's like. And even just the calls, Sonny, just thinking about it, somebody who's calling, when you talk emotionally, Fabio, it doesn't matter. Like, in other words, you're talking to somebody on the other end of that phone whose loved one either just died, whether there's a case or not. That you're taking calls from people, then you got to vet it. Being able to do that, and I mean, I guess at one point, How did you maintain it at one point when you're just getting the calls? Like, not just even going through the case, but the side you're dealing with, it's not good news. Sonny, when you get a call, it's an injured worker, and they're panicking, and they got a family on the line. That's if it's not a catastrophically injured person, and they can even make the call.
Yeah.
Gearing yourself up on a daily basis, how do you, like Fabio said, he's got to kind of separate it after he gets off the phone just so we can – you know, obviously work on the legal part of it. How do you do it?
Well, I think a little bit of it does involve putting yourself in the shoes of that person that's calling so that you can understand what they're going through. You know, the loss of a job, the loss of a regular steady income, how that affects not only them but their family. Are they going to be able to pay their bills? And then, you know, you start thinking about all the things that you need to do to help them.
Yeah. We're going to take a little bit of a break, and we'll have more from the American Justice Radio Network with Sonny Banks after the break.
Pinnacle Medical Plus is a full-service urine toxicology and durable medical equipment company serving patients throughout the continental United States. With over 25 years of industry experience, the professionals at Pinnacle Medical Plus provide high-quality services and products combined with excellent service at a reasonable price. On the urine toxicology side, Pinnacle is a trusted partner that provides the most up-to-date therapeutic drug monitoring technology. On the DME side, Pinnacle offers an extensive list of premium products along with priority delivery services. At Pinnacle Medical Plus, their number one goal is making sure their customers and patients receive the quality care and services they deserve. Contact Pinnacle Medical Plus for all of your urine toxicology and durable medical equipment needs at 888-396-8644 or online at www.pinnaclemedicalplus.com. HealthBridge was established over 30 years ago by compassionate chiropractic physicians who understand the physical limitations that come with aches and pains, trauma, and unforeseen motor vehicle accidents and work injuries. With 8 locations throughout Philadelphia, Montgomery, and Lehigh County, our team of doctors are experienced in evaluating and treating all musculoskeletal injuries. At HealthBridge, we provide chiropractic, therapeutic exercise, active release therapy, joint mobilization, core stabilization, work hardening, and numerous other individualized treatment plans so our patients feel stronger, better, and reinvigorated without pain or limitations. With over 750 five-star Google reviews, our team stays focused and consistent with each new and existing patient to guarantee the best possible result. Please visit our website at healthbridgechiro.com or call now to schedule an appointment 833-422-4766 and experience why HealthBridge is the right choice for you.
They just told us right away that we're going to house you, we're going to feed you, and every single one of his medical bills is just all taken care of.
They've saved my family from financial ruin. It allowed me and my wife both to focus on the most important thing, which was the health and well-being of our son.
We have phenomenal research, outstanding clinical care, and the generosity of public, which allow us to treat patients regardless of what it takes. And that's what makes St. Jude so magical.
At St. Jude Children's Research Hospital, families never receive a bill for treatment, travel, housing, or food, because the only thing a family should worry about is helping their child live.
Doctors send us the toughest cases to be treated at St. Jude, and our patients come from all over the world.
When we come here, they told me, don't worry, everything's been taken care of.
We could never repay St. Jude for what they've given us.
Because of you.
Gracias a ti.
Because of you.
There is St. Jude.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the American Justice Radio Network on WWDB 860 AM. Sonny Banks is our host. I'm Joe Dougherty. We're sponsored by Tony Shore and Pinnacle Medical Plus. Sonny's guest today is Fabio Chirino, renowned medical malpractice attorney. I never ceases to amaze me what experiences that we have, and just getting into somebody else's world and dealing with the daily, every day. And we talk about cancer, potential negligence cases where, Fabio's representing a client who was wrongly either diagnosed or, the treatment was, whatever it was, cancer was the result. And in many cases, it could be death, and just amazingly emotional.
Yeah, I mean, we had an interesting conversation during the break where Fabio was sharing with us, some of the ways that he proves his case, either in a death case situation or someone who has survived cancer. And if you would share that with the listeners, Fabio, that'd be great.
Sure. So one of the things is I really try to capture a day in their life, and we do this by video and photographs. And what we'll do is, we'll have a professional videographer, photographer, follow the patient as they do their daily activities, whatever that may be, and kind of highlight those things. So a jury, in the event that patient is not going to be alive for trial, we can show that to the jury because it's important. One story that I can point out is, right at the eve of trial, I presented prior to trial in my pretrial statement all these photographs and videos of the plaintiff that I want to show. No motion was filed, but on the eve of trial, the defense wants to exclude all that stuff. Mm. And I understand that. That's a lot of emotions, which the judge usually instructs the jury, you can't bring your emotions into this, but we're humans.
Right.
Part of that is motion. But how else would I be able to show who this person was?
Right.
I mean, we're going through medical records, and it's not fair. It's not fair to the patient that they don't get to be shown to the jury. They're not there.
Yeah. How often does that judge allow the pictures for the most part?
I've only had one ruling adverse to me where they blocked some of the pictures, but we worked around it. So we were able to show some pictures, but not all of them.
Yeah, because you're trying to convey the essence of a person.
Correct. I want the jury to understand when we're referencing this person's name that is plastered all over these medical records,
right,
and it's showing up on a big screen, what does this person look like?
Yeah.
What kind of things were they doing? Capture a moment in their life where they were fishing, where they were out shopping, where they're out having a dinner with their loved one, whatever it might be. So I might not be able to capture videos in all instances, but if I do have a video, I'm going to be able to show that to the jury so they can appreciate who was this, patient person, instead of just in a vacuum. We see all these medical records and we see what happened, but what were they? Who are these people?
What else are you generally or usually presenting other than video?
I try to bring in family members to the extent I can. And that process is difficult in and of itself because every family member wants to jump up and, speak on behalf of the deceased or on behalf of the patient. But you have to find those two, three, or four witnesses who will best convey the message of, what this person has gone through. It's not just about factually. It's not just about, I went with so-and-so patient to this doctor visit or to that hospital visit, but also to convey about what this person was like when they were alive or when they were in a better condition before the cancer diagnosis. What kind of things did they like to do?
So are you meeting all these family members and vetting?
Yes. Yeah. So usually we'll do an interview. Sometimes it might just be by phone or by Zoom. And then the next time that we meet to kind of really get into the meat and potatoes of it, it'll be in person. I want to see these people. I want to look into their eyes, just as the jury is going to be doing. I want to make sure that the jury, I can appreciate the same thing as jury is going to be able to appreciate is, as they're looking at this person talking about their loved one, what are they taking away from it? Is it going to have an impact? Is the jury not going to like him? Is the jury going to find that the story is actually lost because of the way this specific witness is telling us?
So you're looking at it from you're micromanaging everything, yes. Because obviously you can't afford to have something, you know, go the wrong way or make the wrong impression,
right,
and jeopardize the situation often when you're how long can some of these cases go before you actually get to court?
In Philadelphia, which is a pretty rapid system, about 3 to 4 years. So 3 to 4 years from suit, I would say. But the process can be longer if you're looking at it from the time that the incident happened. So misdiagnosis before there's a resolution at trial could be 5 to 7 years. And that's, again, Philadelphia County has a much faster pace. If you're looking at Bucks County or Delaware County, Chester County, those can be as long as 7+ years before, you know, from inception of suit to actually getting a resolution by in front of a jury.
How often is it, you know, in comparison? I heard a number one time that in the city of Philadelphia that only a few hundred cases actually make it to court. Is that a year? Is that true?
That is true. That's my understanding as well, too. And it depends on the type of case that it is.
So does that mean that most of them settle beforehand?
A good number do, or they go to alternative dispute resolutions, such as mediation or arbitration. So that they some are diverted that way, some just outright settle. But it depends, and I guess that's where my expertise comes in too, is I know from the moment I identify who the defendants are going to be in a lawsuit, I can almost predict that we're not going to be able to settle this case. As good as it is, we're likely not going to be able to settle until jury selection,
okay,
or the first day of opening statement.
Because I heard that when the insurance company see Fabio Chiarino, when they just this is Fabio. We can do it the easy way or the hard way. I'll be expecting your. I just got this case yesterday morning. Don't waste my time and yours. Click.
Don't you wish it was that way, Fabio?
I do. And,
but of the cases that come in, because if you. I can only imagine because if you feel strong enough to, and you're experienced that you're getting a case, and I'm looking at the numbers here, and you're going to take that case, what is the percentage of cases that settle before, in some way, whether through arbitration or, rather than go to court?
I would say 20% settle about a month before trial.
Okay.
Whether it's outright settlement or we do an ADR, alternative dispute resolution, which could be an arbitration or mediation. And then the other 80%, to the extent that those will settle, will be literally on the eve of trial. Just because of, I want to maximize the amount that a client can get from the case. Because they're owed that. That's their money.
Absolutely.
So yeah. I don't want to shortchange them by saying, I want to be able to get this case off. You know, my books.
Right, right.
It takes as long as it takes until the number is just right to compensate the plaintiff.
Sonny, like you get a lot of work injury cases from other attorneys that obviously don't specialize. It's a very specialized area. So how often, you know, do you get the calls from other attorneys that, you know, is that the way you get cases?
I do. I get some, excuse me, I get referrals from other attorneys. And a lot of times, these are attorneys that don't practice med mal.
Right.
They kind of take those cases, but they don't plan on keeping them. So they might call me and say, can I run this by you? Sure. Let me take a look at it. Send me whatever medical records you have. Put me in contact with the plaintiff or the potential plaintiff. Let me walk through it and I'll get back to you. I don't think I've ever, in 15 plus years that I've been doing med mal, I don't think I've ever taken a call and in that call said,
I'll take the case.
I'll take the case, or I don't think there's anything there. I really want to look at each case.
How do you avoid, and it's interesting, how do you avoid, I was just thinking about this, spending most of your day, aside from the time that you're actually doing law, you know, having a ridiculous amount of people calling you and saying, you know, is this a case? You know what I mean? Other attorneys, I mean, actually vetting cases. Because it must be unbelievable. How do you manage your time, and how do you work that?
So I break up my day. So I allot a certain amount of time to each thing. And unfortunately, it keeps me sane at the end of the day.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, it sometimes spills into the weekend. So I'll be doing work on the weekend. But I want to make sure that I'm allotting the proper amount of time to each matter that I have. My experience allows me to kind of see some of the issues early on.
Yeah.
But you mentioned it too. It's almost like the other attorney is already putting his spin on it. He's trying to vet it almost himself.
Yeah, right.
I want to do that on my own.
Yeah.
So that's why I want to be able to look at the stuff myself and see. And it's happened countless times where a case comes into me with one issue and I'll look at it from a different perspective. I said, you're missing the much bigger picture here. It's not, you know, because of the way the surgery was done. I think in my humble opinion, the surgery seems like it went fine. But you really should look at it as what happened that caused the surgery to be done in the first place in this manner. And a perfect example I have is a gentleman was referred to me from another attorney, but to look at it, the aspect of a spinal surgery that was done, that you go through the front rather than through the back. And they wanted me to look at it from that aspect because it rendered him quadriplegic.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm looking at it, well, why was that surgery done from the front as opposed to the back? So when you're looking at it, it's because he had a tumor, but because of that, the way that tumor grew, they had to do it from the front rather than the rear. So then I'm looking at it, backtracking it. When was this tumor diagnosed and could they have done something to diagnose it sooner?
Jeez.
So that was the larger case. And you know, I got him a very, very good result in that case because I looked at it from that. From the spinal surgery, it might have not been a very large case, but from the misdiagnosis of cancer, it was a very big case.
Talk about the potential. I mean, I don't, it's even a little uncomfortable to talk about it, but what are the range of potential settlements that you, well, not potential, but settlements that you've achieved for people?
Pretty much all the settlements I've done are in the seven-figure range because the kind of cases that we're dealing with, you know, misdiagnosed breast cancer case where the mother leaves behind three young kids, you know, or, you know, she was the main breadwinner of the family.
And if I can interrupt, Fabio, are you usually suing one medical provider or multiple medical providers?
It depends on the case. If I see clear cut, it was this physician or this hospital that is likely negligent, I just focus on that. I know some other attorneys and other law firms will do kind of like a shotgun effect and then whittle it down from there as the case goes on. I want to get the ones that I feel are most culpable to make my case the strongest. But often than not, there is more than one specialty involved. It might be a primary care physician and the specialist that the patient was referred to, a gynecologist or a gastroenterologist. So I might have to sue those different practices in the same case, or radiologist that didn't read a study correctly, but you know the family physician should have caught it or something like that. So I might have to involve several different specialties, their practice, perhaps even the hospital, perhaps even the health system that employs them. So it could be different layers.
Talk about medical experts. You know, the pool for what, you know, in other words, how difficult is it to get an expert and how important are they? And don't you have to get a certification before you make a decision, you know, get in, whether you can even move forward?
That is really correct. It's a good point, Joe. Thanks for bringing it up. By law, I'm required within a certain amount of time after I file the complaint. So I have everything I need to file the complaint and identify what I think is the breach of standard of care by the different healthcare providers we've sued. But within a certain amount of time after that, 60 days, I have to get a written report from an expert that says, yes, there was a deviation from the standard of care.
By the way, I do that on the side, so I'll be happy to help.
I'll make sure to get that.
Yeah, give me a call.
So, and that's important. And I tell my clients up front, because it is not just I making that decision. I might feel, yes, there is. What you went through was terrifically horrible, but unfortunately, there's no case here.
Right.
And there is times where I go to one expert and he says, no negligence. Okay, well, I want a second or third opinion just because of a gut feeling I'm getting
right.
or my experience in a very similar kind of case that I had a good result in previously. But the thing with the experts is it has to be just the right kind of expert.
Yeah.
They have to be the same certification or higher, such as a board certification by a medical specialty or higher than the doctor who I'm going to claim
so the credibility
is negligent.
Right. Right.
But they have to be vetted too. I just can't, you know, call up, look in, as you mentioned, the yellow pages. I can't just flip through to the yellow pages of Google a doctor in infectious diseases and, oh, well, he's obviously at the top of the list. Let me call him.
Yeah.
So I have to vet them as well. They have to be somebody that I can trust and rely on, not only to sign their name to this report, but then come in and testify about it in court.
You're generally using medical experts or doctors to support your case,
right,
that do this kind of work on a regular basis.
Right.
And used to testifying.
And the law even requires that they have to be within the 5 years still practicing that same kind of medicine. So it can't be somebody who's retired, hasn't seen a patient in years. I typically go after someone who is currently practicing, seeing a good volume of patients clinically, but then also perhaps teaches other doctors and writes. Those are three of the big things that I look at. I don't want somebody who's just a scholar who writes a lot but never talks about it. I don't want somebody who just spends all their time in a doctor's office. I want them to be well-rounded.
Well, I'm off the list then. but having said that, this is amazing, really.
It is.
Having said that, what's the fastest you've ever had a conversation with somebody, taking a case, and where the insurance company and they just knew, listen, this is obvious. Are there ever cases where it's so obvious that the insurance company just says, let's just get this over with before? I mean, what's the fastest you've ever brought a case to resolution?
I've only had about maybe a dozen or so cases that we resolved pre-litigation. But I've had several that we resolve once I file a lawsuit and before we even start getting into the discovery phase where we're exchanging information, I'm taking the doctor's deposition. So before that phase, where the risk manager or the general counsel will approach me and say, look, we see where you're going with this. Let's talk numbers. Let's maybe do a mediation. Let's see if we can try to resolve this without getting more involved in this case. And I've had several of those.
So how long, and I know I don't want people to be, I'm just saying,
yeah.
What is the fastest ever?
The fastest is probably 6 months. Wow. Months from the moment that they walk in the door that I see they have a solid case and to the point where I'm able to resolve it.
Wow.
And that's usually, and
here's the doctor. Here he is drinking a beer in the operating room. I'm being sarcastic. Well,
I wish I could get those kind of cases yeah. Because
a lot of these
that
doctors,
kind of leverage is powerful.
A lot of these doctors and hospitals are concerned about their reputation.
Oh yeah,
so they want to get these cases resolved.
How many HIPAA cases are there? It's where because as you well know, when HIPAA is such a big deal, and I sit there and go, well, it's only 250 cases a year. What are you so worried for? But how often does HIPAA come into HIPAA compliance and dealing with the privacy issues?
Every single time. I mean, because I have to make sure. I mean, from the moment they come in, I have them sign a release that allows me.
I don't mean that. I'm saying
okay.
The doctor's office themselves, I call, my wife says, do me a favor, call there and find out if my test results are whatever. They can't tell me to give me the information because of HIPAA. My question is, how many cases are actually related to that, where the privacy, somebody's privacy has been breached?
We've had several of that. And the funny part is, it's exactly in the same scenario where they're putting in these tools to protect against breach of privacy. So the rollover of these electronic health records,
yeah,
where they're sending email messages or even text messages to people that are not supposed to be getting them, or doctors returning calls and it's the wrong patient or giving the wrong medication. So we have several of those where clearly the privacy has been breached.
Wow.
Too many to really count, honestly.
Right. And are they big cases or are they?
They typically don't amount to a whole lot because if you look further enough, then usually they've remedied the breach.
Okay. So does there have to be damages when it comes to a breach or something?
There are some instances where there are damages, but in reality, the damages are pretty nominal. So a lot of times I kind of instruct the patients on how to handle that matter themselves with me giving some background support so they can kind of maximize what they get a return from.
I just want to know, so when I call, I'm talking to the doctor about my wife, what the hell are you worried about?
Is there a particular cancer that you deal with the most?
Breast cancer cases are pretty high right now on my docket. We also have some gastrointestinal cases, some colon cancer cases that are pretty high. But there's not any one specific. It's pretty broad. Mm-hmm. This just is what happens to be on my docket for now.
Right.
But it changes depending on, you know, a number of circumstances.
Well, unbelievable show. I mean, you know, I certainly, you know, thinking about a lot of the things that you're talking about, it just gets you emotional because we're talking about cancer and you're talking about, you know, what when somebody walks into Fabio's office, obviously they've already gone through some of the most, you know, difficult times.
Yeah. Their life expectancy is not long.
Okay. Yeah, no, that's what I'm saying. It's so emotional. If you would, Fabio, tell our listeners a little bit about where they can contact you if there's any interest in getting in touch.
Sure. So the easiest way to do that is to call me, 267-615-8090, or you can also email me at fabioascarino@gmail.com. It's FABIOASCIARRINO. I'm very responsive, either email or telephone. I like to keep it personal and have a one-on-one contact rather than leave a message and somebody will get back to you in a week. But
that's and the law firms?
The law firm is the law office of Fabio Ascarino, and I'm also affiliated with Emmanuel Law Firm. So either one of those two, you can Google and find our contact information, or like I said, call me on the cell phone number that I gave, or the telephone number I gave, and the email address.
Absolutely. Well, Sonny, another really impactful
phenomenal show. Very phenomenal.
Thank you for having me, guys. Appreciate it very much.
Appreciate you coming back.
Really contact information, Sonny?
Sure. Bankslaw, 215-561-1000. Email address is www.bankslaw.com.
All right. Well, listen, I just want to, on behalf of Sonny, thank Fabio Ascarino for coming in and sharing your experiences. And if God forbid something happens, man, I would not hesitate to recommend Fabio Ascarino for my loved one, because my God, it's such a an impactful area and such an emotional. So thank you, sir.
Thank you, Joe.
I agree.
I want to thank our listeners for tuning in to the American Justice Radio Network with Sonny Banks. We're sponsored by Tony Shore and Pinnacle Medical Plus. On behalf of Sonny and Fabio Ascarino, I'm Joe Docherty. Thanks for listening.